Susan, you were telling me a little bit earlier that you have a particular history behind the composition of the poem L'Heure Bleue.
What happened was, when I was working on another poem in the book called What It Is, I have a metaphor in there about the blue of the sky, and it ended up a Paris sky the bluest glacier could get lost in. But I had a lot of trouble coming up with something for blue, so I went around asking everybody I know, what are blue things? And I looked up in the OED and I just had this long list. So after I wrote this poem, I had all these things that were blue laying around. And one of the things that I had come across was L'Heure Bleue. And actually, I made a mistake because I found out later that the French, when they say L'Heure Bleue, they mean dawn, not dusk. But I thought they meant dusk. And of course, it looks the same. And dusk was always and is always still my favorite time of the day. There's something about the way the sky looks. I just love it. And especially in New York, it was gorgeous. And so that just sort of came together in this poem.
In that poem, you are writing about a state of mind that's also twilight state of mind. And that seems to be a state of mind about which you like to write. You catch characters in that in-between state or in a moment of decision. Often your poems are about ethical problems, or they're about delaying gratification or hoping to extend the moment of gratification by delaying it before you even get to it. That poem in particular seems really strongly to do that. That's an interest of yours. It's something that you find intriguing that calls you to it.
Well, it's a weird thing. I don't know if you had this experience with your own collections, but when I was writing these poems, I didn't see connections like that. And then when I had to put the manuscript together, I had to start looking for them. And even then, I didn't see them so much myself as I saw them in the feedback other people gave me when they were talking about the book. And then I was like, oh, yeah, I guess that is an interest of mine. And one of the things that seems to be happening in a lot of these poems, and I think in that one especially, is I'm very attracted to and also repelled by romance in general. All those notions of romance that are so seductive and in many ways so false, but yet they're so seductive you can't quite ever let them go. And for me, I didn't think about it beforehand. I was just in L'Heure Bleue, all I was really trying to do was describe the city at that time, and I was focusing on the descriptions, not on what resonated from that. But I guess what came out in it is that, that is that time, that sort of anticipation of the night out and getting ready and everything, and you're able to forget the realities of that are going to come in the morning, kind of thing.
The Japanese call it mitsuri, the time of where one thing turns to another, one condition turns to another. That brings to mind another question I've had about your work is it's always clear to me that there's in your writing a crossroads between something that's a richly textured lyric, highly engaged free verse music, and yet the voice and the subject matter is often subject matter that's very, very troubling, troublesome or elegiac. And that mixture is what I think often creates the resonance I feel in your poems. And you see that in several of the pieces you read last night. I'm thinking of that harrowing poem entitled Art. And I guess what that brings me to is a question is what comes first in your writing process? Is it a connection to the language, to the music, or is it first a connection to the subject matter?
That's such a hard question. I'm not sure I know. I can probably answer it better for individual poems. I think art is the only poem I ever wrote the way that I wrote it. I was actually going through this situation at the time, and I was working doing artisan schools. And here I was in this horrible high school where they put me in this class where, the kids were falling asleep on me and all the stuff you see in high school. And my own son was hospitalized, and I was getting these frantic calls from him and trying to teach. And during my break, I didn't have a private place to go. I was in the teacher's break room, and the teachers there were really beaten down, and they just sat around and complained about the kids all the time. And I just sat off in a corner, and there was a typewriter there, and I just started to write what was on my mind. I wasn't really even thinking about a poem. then, of course, I went back to it and began to think about language and try to work it. But that's very unusual for me. I usually write about things that are quite in the past. Very rare for me to write about something that's happening at the time. And I would say, in general, the language, at least consciously, the language comes first for me. But I'm not sure that that's subconsciously true. But that's what I think about mostly when I start.
Well, could you also talk a little bit about a poem you read last night, the title poem of the book, Muse, which is partly a monologue in the voice of Vivian Elliott, partly a kind of sampling of quotations from the Bloomsbury and Elliott circle, and partly a lyric poem describing, you know, aspects of her life. That's a longer poem. It's a poem of a different sort of ranginess from some of the other ones. And I think listeners might be interested in how that poem was composed.
I can't remember exactly when I first decided to write about her, but I think it was I had been reading something and came across Virginia Woolf's quote. And that upset me so much that Virginia Woolf would be so cruel and dismissive of this woman that was clearly suffering.
The bag of ferrets around her neck.
Right. And very... Vivian was a talented poet. She was an editor. She did all sorts of things that she didn't get any credit for. And what I finally decided about Virginia Woolf, because I don't want to... I like Virginia Woolf. I don't want to see her as being less than kind, is maybe Vivian was a little too close for comfort. She didn't want to be the mad woman at the end of the table. But at any rate, it may have started with that, and then at some point I saw Tom and Viv, and then I did a lot of research. I read all the Elliott biographies I could find. I read all the stuff on the Bloomsbury group. And I had all this research material. And so when I sat down to write the poem, the reason the poem's in sections is because I had no idea where to begin. So I just sort of jumped in and wrote these individual sections without knowing how many there would be or how they would tie together or where they interested me. The first section was, it almost wrote itself because I just had all these horrible things that they'd said about her. And then I had that little detail about Elliott. That was one of the things that seemed to me so unjust. Elliott would come to dinner parties wearing makeup and lipstick and green face powder and wear a truss and just be completely crazy, and nobody said a thing. And Vivian would be loud and drunk, and it would be horrible. The second section, I wanted to imagine what it would have been like for her when she first started on all these drugs. And I had this idea for her going out in the countryside. So I researched what grows in the countryside in England, and I discovered that there's this amazing thing with bluebells, that they form this thick carpet in parts of the wood. And I just love that image of her out there. So that's kind of where that came from. The third section, again, almost wrote itself, just what all the things that they take away from you when you're ward in Chancery. The last section, actually, I had showed a draft of the poem to Art Homer, who was my very first poetry teacher, wonderful poet and writer. And I said, you know, what do you think? And he said, well, I think what's missing is Vivian speaking. And that's the good advice that he gave me. And then I just kind of imagined her at the end there and spoke through her.
It sounds like research is part of your composition process. Is that something you trust to, and does it give you the sustenance, or do you feel like it helps you along? Do you ever worry about depending on it too much? Or, because I know I use that, that's part of my own process, building in other streams of information into making a poem.
I never worry about it because I think it only, I mean, the only thing I worry about is sometimes that I love doing it. And of course, it's much easier than writing the poems, so that I can, you know, spend a long time doing it when I ought to be getting to the poem. It's dangerous in that way. But in terms of worrying about how it affects the poems, I think it only can make them stronger, because I want things in my poems. You know what I mean? I want real things, real information. Besides which, to me, it's part of the process. It's not separate. It's part of what I enjoy doing. Even if I'm writing something sort of autobiographical, I still want to go find out, I don't know if it's set somewhere, what actually grew there, what is there. Maybe the other reason is because I'm not out living an adventurous life at this point in my life, doing all sorts of things. And so I live in my head a lot, read a lot, and it just sort of naturally, that's what I write about.
writing what you know is one of those, that's a very hoary old writerly cliche. And, you know, I guess maybe a lot of the time, maybe the advice should be the exact opposite of that, right? What you don't know or what you need to know, and you will find out ways of knowing that are new by making those things combine.
Yeah. I think so.
And I think it's, Gregory, I think it's also what you're saying. One of the things that interests me most in the poems that I love, that other people write, are connecting things, seeing things. When you were talking about Levis's poetry and you were saying, you know, about the nature of all poetry being political, well, I think, of course, that's true. Everything's political because you don't live in a vacuum. You live in your society. You live under your government. You live with the history that's come before you. And to me, the richest poems are the ones that set the individual within that context. I mean, I certainly can't always do it, but it's certainly what I admire and what I think the best poetry does in many ways.
Well, you know, when you set the terms that way, it kind of mandates a poetry that is a kind of poetry of witnessing that has a lot of autobiographical strands, a kind of poetry which is maybe dramatic or narrative. Mm-hmm. And I'm really intrigued lately by the fact that a lot of my students, a lot of younger poets, are really reluctant to employ a lot of autobiographical material. They're also very reluctant to create a kind of linear narrative context for their mm-hmm. poems as well. And I guess the pendulum has swung away from those concerns. Why are those concerns of such importance to you, I guess? And why do you think those methods are of late looked on by with suspicion by younger writers?
The second part of your question, I truly don't know, except that I think that in many ways the younger generations are a lot less idealistic and maybe less naive is a better way to put it. We're roughly all the same generation. And I hate the glorifying nostalgia of the 60s, but for all the really stupid stuff that happened and destructive stuff, there was an idealism and a very humane component to it. I mean, we may have been dumb, but that was genuine, I think. And I think, you know, the world that they've come up in, they don't see the world that way. They don't, all those things that happen to us, to them are just history. And maybe that has to do with it. You know, maybe there's a mistrust of the personal and the narrative out of that. I really don't know that. Why it's important to me, I don't know any other way to see the world, I guess. I was telling Gregory, my father died, it's almost 2 years now, and I've been writing a lot about him. And I can't see him without seeing the fact that he was a Jewish male in America who came up at a time when there were certain stereotypes about that, certain levels of anti-Semitism externally and internally, and how those shaped him. And I just think that's reality. I think the way you are in society, I just don't think you can separate it. The question about the formal thing with narrative and the lyric, this has always been a struggle for me. I remember when I was a student and when I was working with Linda, one of the things Linda said to me, and I still have it in a notebook of a commonplace book I have of stuff, was that I was a narrative poet. I had an interest that demanded narrative, but my method at that time was largely lyric, which was how I was initially taught. And that's how I started writing. My first poems were just very much short lyrics, captured the moment. And it was a challenge for me, and still is in many ways, to be able to combine them. Because, you know, one of the things with narrative poetry, some of it is not lyrical at all. Some of it, they just lose that. And that's my first love in the poem, so I always kind of want them both.
When you were selecting poems for The Extraordinary Tide, was that something that informed your choices?
That was the most interesting process. And doing the anthology, much of it was misery. The permissions is just a horrible experience. But the selection of the poems was wonderful. It was another education. And the way we worked was Aaron and I, you know, Aaron is 15 years younger than I, so there was a generational difference, which was great. We came up, Art was her first teacher too. So we came up with sort of the same poetic background. We knew each other's work really intimately. We can think, you know, together in sort of a shorthand about poetry. But we also have some really different tastes and interests. Aaron really is interested in a lot of language poetry, that sort of stuff, although she is less interested in it now, but at the time, whereas I just, you know, as the Quakers say, it doesn't speak to my condition, I just don't get it. But because of that, what we wanted to do was we wanted to, while obviously our taste informed our choices, we also really wanted to go beyond that, and we truly wanted to show a spectrum of what was happening. And so what our agreement was is we both had to agree on any poems that finally went in, but there are poems there that are more reflective of her taste and some that are more of mine. What it did for me personally was so great because I like all the poems in there. And I mean, that's honestly true. Nothing went in there that I didn't think was a fine poem. But when I would be working on them and I would be going through, there would always be the ones that, you know, just knock you back in your chair. And it just kind of reinforced for me what I do value in poetry. What makes the difference between a poem that I sort of respect and think is a good poem and those poems that are just the best thing in life, right? When you read a really great poem, there's nothing like that. So my personal taste, you know, of course informed it, but I didn't want a book of just poems like the poems I would want to write, mm-hmm. and neither did she. And I hope and I think that we achieved that.
Now I have a follow-up question to that. I've recently been reading Muriel Rukeyser. I talked to you about that last night in, you know, preparation for this class I'm teaching the middle generation. And I know that her writing and her example had this huge impact on that first generation of feminist poets who came along on the scene in about the early 1970s. I mean, No More Masks, that
right.
probably the most influential of those anthologies,
right.
came from a line, that title came from a line of Rukeyser's. How do you think the poets you've selected, you and Aaron, and The Extraordinary Tide, as a generation of women writers, differ from those poets of 30 years ago?
Well, first of all, it's not one generation in there. We've got Eleanor Wilner, we've got women.
Jean Valentine.
We've got women. I think the oldest poet was 90, Madeline DeFries. So we have older women, we have the women my age, women Aaron's age, and we have some of the younger women, too, in their 20s, although we try to keep it to people who had two books. So that's sort of, you know, you had mostly a little bit older than in their 20s by that. But I think that all the women, whatever generation, were enormously liberated by women like Rukeyser. Wilner talks about, and we were so thrilled with her introduction. I mean, when we got it, both of us separately, miles away, just were floored. We sent her a big thing of roses because it was like she got it exactly what we wanted, and she articulated it so beautifully. And she talks about what the common thread is here, that all these voices are set against the silence that came before. And Rukeyser and Rich, people of that generation, they broke that silence. And I don't know where any of us would be without them, if we would even be. So we all owe them an enormous debt, I think.